and Chris, and this is my Writing Table podcast, where we talk to authors and other creatives about the writing world and what it takes to create the books that we love to read. Ready? Pull up a chair and let's begin. Vanessa Riley is the award-winning author of Island Queen, A Good Morning America Buzz Pick. Riley's historical novels showcase the hidden histories of Black women and women of color, emphasizing strong sisterhoods and dazzling multicultural communities. Her works encompass historical fiction, historical romance, and historical mystery, and have been reviewed by The Washington Post, Entertainment Weekly, NPR, Publishers Weekly, and The New York Times. This Southern Irish Trini girl holds a doctorate in mechanical engineering and a master's in industrial engineering and engineering management from Stanford. Riley also earned a BS and MS in mechanical engineering from Penn State University. Her research skills have helped NASA, GM, Hewlett-Packard, and several startups. Yet her love of history, Caribbean, Georgian, and Regency, and lattes overwhelmed her passion for math and has led to the publication of over 20 titles. Vanessa is a member and former president of the Regency Fiction Writers, a member of the Georgia Writers Association, the Historical Novel Society, Crime Writers of Color, and she sits on the board of the Christian Book Lovers Retreat. She's an avid baker who loves creating her grandma's cake recipes. You can find Vanessa writing on her southern porch with proper amounts of caffeine. Her latest novel is Murder on Drury Lane. Welcome, Vanessa.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm great. I'm so excited to have you here. And since the last time we've spoken, you have been very busy. I want to go back to the beginning. Can you recall the moment when you said, I'm going to be a writer?
I sort of said it when I was in high school. Back then, looking to try and do this full time to earn a meaningful wage, well, as a woman of color, it just didn't look like a, you know, lightning has to strike. And then once a generation, you'll get a Toni Morrison, you'll get a Beverly Jenkins, you'll get a Brenda Jackson, you'll get some of these wonderful ladies. And I wasn't into those odds because I was very good at math.
What I call a math head.
I'm worse than that. I'm a nerd, right? So it's like the nerd goes looking for somebody with a pocket protector. That was me. And did the whole nine yards going to science camp and coming home, Mom, look at my gold medallion and no future, you know. But my mother, a beautiful woman, she sat me down and she was like, baby, you always need to be able to pay your bills. And so that's when we look at that lens of what is a viable career, what's an option. The odds are better with engineering. And she's absolutely right, especially when you get a doctorate. It pays the bills. I've worked on some great projects with some startups across the country. I've worked for General Motors. I've done projects for NASA, some Microsystems, Hewlett-Packard. I love engineering. But when you have a passion, it comes back. I definitely remember a couple of bosses being like, Vanessa, this diecast manufacturing report is way too interesting.
Just the facts, ma'am.
Just the facts. You know, you didn't want to know what they felt. I had a difficult pregnancy and I had to literally sit down and do nothing for 5 months. My husband bravely walking on eggshells brought down some of my old journals. And I saw a story that I'd written in high school. I'm like, I know more. Actually, I didn't know more, and it was a struggle, but the feeling comes back, the writing comes back, and it's been a journey.
What a great story.
For me, the engineering is a backdrop. I will use it to answer the questions, which I always answered in my projects, how and why? How should a system be organized? How should it work? Why is this the best way to do something? Why is this the particular component needed for this particular solution set? So when you turn it to writing, it's the motivations. Why are these people doing these things? And then how do they do it? And that how could be like, how is the cloth manufactured? How are the houses built? Why are they pointed in this direction? Why are they shaped this way? Why, you know, so it's taming that beast of asking so many questions that you never actually write, but using it for good. I want every reader to feel like they are there in the backdrop, in the ballrooms, in the studies, the parlors, the bedchambers, on the battlefields. I want them to feel like they're there.
We think about our children in terms of the right brain, left brain. What you're describing is a beautiful marriage of both, because you are able to take all of the math and the science with this beautiful creative talent, and it works for you. It's what, 20 books down the road? Is that right?
20, 25, somewhere in that neighborhood.
About 20, 25. Yeah, just a few extras there.
Well, you know, it's like the fundamental question. What do you count as done? Revision, copy edits.
Yeah.
Targeted, you know, what is done on the shelf? You know, what exactly is done? you count it like that.
Are you an outliner? Do you plan methodically before you write? Or is this where you get spontaneous?
I'm in the middle. This is going to be the conversation. And just as a side note, there's this one test in high school that you're supposed to determine your quadrants. Mm-hmm. I was always dead center. So that should let you know. And I took it twice every time, dead center. And it's like when you see your administrators going, what the hell? I am somewhat in the middle. And what I do is I have a timeline. So whatever book I'm writing or whatever genre I'm writing, I have a timeline. So it could be, you know, somewhere between 1755 to 1830, all the world events, because whatever your characters are going through, they know what's happening in the world and they're going to talk about it. It's going to affect their lives, et cetera. And then I get it narrowed down to the character. So if I'm doing historical fiction, cradle to grave, where was this person? Where were they born? All the people they possibly interacted with, documented that they've interacted with, et cetera. Every step where they move to, because all of these things influence each other. So we've got this structure. We know where we're heading. The imaginative or the creative part is the motivations. Why would someone go there? Why would they choose to take this path when there's so many other paths? Why would they choose this person to be their person? Why here? Why England? Why not America? Why not Haiti? Why not Jamaica? Why? So you have the structure part to understand the goals and the actions that you have to end up at. But you get to pants almost sometimes till you feel this, because you've done this research, you think you know the era, you think you know these people, you've read their letters, you read how other people are describing these folks. And you want to bring that alive because now you kind of understand their motivations. You want to carry that through. But to me, that's the pantsing. That's the imaginative part. That's the fictional mm-hmm. piece of everything, putting those through.
And how do you incorporate your roots?
Ooh, okay. So mom was she was a literature woman. So she made sure we read Shakespeare and Thoreau and Baldwin. Dad from Trinidad and Tobago, he was a storyteller. So he was rhythm and words and imagery, blending of the two. You do this too. Think about how white space will amplify what's going on the page, mm-hmm. even from a visual construct. I've been playing lately, like, how do I actually lay the book out? Even though these books are traditionally published, you know, what's on that other page? Is it a poem? Is it some sort of masthead statement? Is it a newspaper clipping? How am I grounding the reader who has a modern sensibility, a modern time frame, into these places so that they feel like they're there and they feel like these are authentic to those time periods? So it's a visual thing, it's a sound thing, and it's this merging of fact and fiction, and it's fun. It's a lot of fun.
You have such an interesting background. And so to be able to share that, and you do it so well. I'm going to move forward now and talk about how you're tackling suspense. Tell us a little bit about the series and then what we can expect to see in Murder on Drury Lane and what's coming after that.
When I was doing research for Sister Mother Worry, which was my second historical fiction, about the Haitian Revolution and the aftermath, I came across this really fascinating fact that I couldn't put in the book, but I had to put somewhere, that all the abolition movements in the world stop because Haiti's free. They are literally in a panic. William Wilberforce, Elijah Macaulay, Thomas Clarkson, everybody's sitting around. They don't know what to do because Haiti's free. It's kind of like, good y'all being free, but now y'all want to run stuff? Mm-hmm. So I started thinking, what if you were a woman of memes, of color. You're in this time frame and you think the world is about to open up and everybody's recognizing everyone's humanity. And then the doors close. How do you use your influence, even though you're on shaky ground, because you're in between these worlds of who will accept you, who won't accept you into their company, et cetera? How do you make the world right? So I started thinking about this heroine, Lady Worthing, marriage of convenience. You know, she's accepted by some, she has means, but she's also secretly trying to get this abolition movement started. But she also has this really wonderful tack of finding dead bodies. I give that all to my mom because every Sunday night we watched Murder, She Wrote.
I did too.
Honestly, so I think good. Jessica was a serial killer.
I always wondered, like, okay, how is it that you always are the one who stumbles upon the bodies?
Everywhere she went, book conference, she's still a person dead. So I was like, that's Abigail. She's living her life. And there's a body in Murder in Westminster. She's arguing with her neighbor, a war hero. He literally just got back in January. I imagine him standing 4 inches from Lord Nelson when Lord Nelson was shot. So he's always in the back of his mind remembering it was 4 inches determining whether a war hero, the man, the legend of the admiral of the Navy of England is living or dying and versus me living or dying. So he might have some post-traumatic stress issues going on. But he's got these two wonderful greyhounds, well-behaved, and she has a terrier named Teacup, and she knows that those dogs are terrorizing her dog. Might be the other way around. Her neighbor puts up this fence between their two properties right on St. James Park. And one night, the dogs are going crazy, and they go out, and they're doing their little side snipping between each other, and they find his estranged wife dead on the fence, but on Abigail's side of the fence. And Abby thinks in her mind, who is London going to believe? The war hero did it? Or the woman that you don't believe should be here, should be married to a baron, should be living in Westminster? So she has to join forces with this man she despises in order to figure out who did it because they give each other alibis.
And then,
so she figured it out and, you know, Henderson may not have done it, but at least, you know. Big Murder, She Wrote. In Drury Lane, Abigail's estranged husband, he's an explorer. She went to Bath to meet with him. He did not come. She returns to London disappointed. And when she goes, her house has been ransacked. Someone has broken in and ransacked it. Magistrate and her godfather say, we have to pretend until we figure out who did this, let's pretend like nothing happened. So you're going to go to the theater that night. And Abigail's, how am I going to pretend like nothing happened? My world, my safety has been violated. But she's there at the theater, and of course, somebody gets killed. Well, that's a great distraction for her. She's got to figure it out. And that troublesome neighbor, he actually rented the box next to her. He sees that this murder has happened too. So the two of them go and they try and figure out who murdered Anthony Danielson. He's a burgeoning playwright who last Tuesday decided to change his life and be a good man. Last Tuesday. Unfortunately, the things you did before last Tuesday are still there. For those who love this, one of the potential suspects may be the key vote on the abolition bill that is finally making its way through Parliament. No good deed goes unpunished.
2025 books, mm-hmm. And you've done a lot of romance, a lot of historical romance, historical fiction, and now you've jumped into this mystery space. Were you capturing any differences in how you were plotting, how you were building the stories?
In the process, no, but the plotting in the murder mystery is a little tighter. You have to know where those bodies are going to show up. For me, that's a decision prior to even writing. Where are the bodies going to show up? That is very different. For historical fiction is, where do I want to start this story and where do I want to end? Sometimes I don't want to, even though I know Cradle to Grave, I might not want to show Cradle to Grave. I may want to show that moment where life changes and then the resolution of where the person I'm centering on has learned the great lesson, has something that'll impart something to the reader. So they take something away from that journey. That's a very different thing. And with historical romance, you promise they're going to end up happily ever for now or happily ever after. Once again, determining what that journey is, you might be questioning, is she going to stick the landing? Because maybe they shouldn't be together. Maybe it's better that they're not together, or these obstacles that are in their way. What is that journey? So that once again, the reader feels satisfied that they've invested their time reading this book and they're getting their expectation, but yet the journey is different than anything else they've ever read. So it's the same bucket, but just different ways of parsing it.
It's always interesting to me to talk to authors of mystery, suspense, psychological thrillers. I have always assumed that you had to know the full mystery before you started writing it. About half of the authors tell me they kind of know where it's going to go.
You know, from reading Moseley and Agatha Christie, you have to not be worried so much about justice, but who did it. So the person who dies has to not be this squeaky clean, you know, wonderful individual. They've got to be somebody who, you know, maybe had it coming. And then when you think about the layers of who may have had it coming, that tells you all the potential suspects. At the beginning, I firmly say this is going to be who did it. But sometimes that may switch because you've written it in such a way that, you know what, this is a possibility. Currently writing one, I took out somebody that I was like, nope, it's better if he's actually still alive. So redo. You want these twists in romance structure. It's point A to point B, so to speak, with lots of zigzagging. Here, maybe go point D to back to A to Z. You want these red herrings. You want people to be guessing and surprised. And once again, that thriller aspect of, oh my goodness, they've figured it out. Now they're running for their lives kind of thing. You know, it's a balance, but it's how it comes out on the paper. So you're subject to changing. I'm not so wedded to what I pre-think that I'm going to hamper the delivery. If I think it's going to be this much more impactful, that as long as I haven't made the typical errors, I've already said they were someplace else, you know, that it's impossible for them to have done it, I will make the changes. There are lots of mysteries being written and you want your reader to come back. You want them to root for your hero or heroine as they're trying to figure out who did it and learning more about their lives, et cetera. I have a plan at the beginning, but I'm not wedded to that if what gets on those pages is more compelling.
As writers, we're told that readers enjoy being able to predict to some degree. They want to know they're on the right track.
I'm planting the red herrings. Some of them are obvious red herrings. Some of them are very subtle. I personally want to have a thread of truth with the Lady Worthing series. The prologue is always the first victim in their point of view. So you get to see through their eyes everybody who potentially could have done it, as well as what they thought about each one of these people through conversations or them rambling to themselves, et cetera, et cetera. And that should be a piece of evidence that you have that Abby doesn't even have.
Do you use an unreliable narrator?
Yes. I love an unreliable narrator. Mm-hmm. But you have that little bit of evidence that no one else except the murderer, you have a little bit of a little edge. So you are at times you're competing against Abby. But then there's sometimes you're walking right with her and you're discovering things and you are finding things out as the reader goes through the Lady Worthing mystery. So it's a hodgepodge, but it's a fun hodgepodge. And I believe in the directions that you're writing, and what you're writing is the most powerful thing. It will supersede a pre-planned plot if it's more compelling, if it's stronger, if it's going to have people on the edge of their seats flipping those pages.
Do you feel like you could go for a long time with this?
Yes, I would love 30 books. Cool. Sue Grisham is a hero, so I want 30 books. There's just lots of fun to play with. So it could be 30. I see it going 30.
When you started, what was your pre-planning like? Talking about the series, 30 books, a lot of threads to pull. How long did it take you to come up with Abby's story? It
took a little bit. Having a cast of characters, this is one of the things writing historical romance. You're always in this frame of 2 to 3 book series, and you always have very engaging background players that you could easily pull. So that part is good. And then, you know, I watched a lot of television with my mom. A bit of Dynasty in here. There's some Dallas in here. There's Remington Steele. There's Matlock, you know, and of course, Murder, She Wrote. You mix all that together. you have a cast of characters. Her godfather, I had done research and I found that the Prince Regent had a man who would fix things for him. There's so much that can just go from that underworld kind of thing. The war hero and his extended family. You think of the Carringtons, there's the father and levels of crazy that goes on here, and then the children have levels of crazy. So, you know, we've got to cast the characters. And in Abby's split family, because her mother left her father.
You keep a series Bible.
You have to. I use a tool called Plotter, and you're able to incorporate pictures because now I have a map of what her house looks like, because she's walking around in her house and there's things going on. A house of Henderson. So what does the house look like? They go places that luckily Drury Lane, there you get the old maps of what that building looked like. So you can plot things out. But yeah, character, eye color, hair, their quirks, because everybody has a quirk. Something they do. So it's repeatable because you won't remember it. I even have like a basic chart of spellings because I will mess up your name given the opportunity. It's a thing. So you have to have a series Bible. Even with eye color, you want to kind of have a chart so that not everybody's brown eyes, not everybody's blue eyes, you know, whatever that thing is. Mannerisms are trying to figure out what someone's thinking or saying, those extra things. If you introduce anything, a new relationship, a new person, you need to have that written down and added to the Bible because you'll forget and you might need to pull somebody from a prior book into a future book. You need to know the introduction and the backstory with that person. Sometimes the crutch is a look, right? Everybody can have that same look. It's your writer crutch, you know, to show surprise.
Fill in the blank, drop our gaze. We're going to shift our gaze. Then when you get ready to send it in, then you start searching. Okay, I said that 72 times. That's not going to work.
Exactly, exactly. Or breathe.
Blew out a hard breath, exhaled sharply. I mean, fuck. Before you started writing, like, didn't it seem like there were a lot more words?
Sometimes.
It just seemed like it was endless. And now I feel like I need some more words.
My favorite is I need some more body actions. Like I need to, you know, like you don't think about it, right? But you know, everybody's nodding. No, what are they also doing? You know, what are those things? And then once again, if you assign somebody that quirk, you gotta write it down. You won't remember that they have this quirk. Margie Lawson is a good one.
Oh, yeah.
Her packets and taking her immersion classes. There are things as a writer you naturally do, but that level of control and knowing when to amplify, because everybody can't be like this. You can flow people through scenes and give people their own breath as they go through the next, you know, whatever's happening in the book. So as organized as you can be, but still allowing yourself to have some flexibility. Mm-hmm. For you to enjoy the story, because, you know, you're your first reader, you're in there and you're rooting for these people. Your reactions are just as important. And so if you're feeling, I need a breath, I need to really amp this up, go with that flow and it makes for good writing.
You can look at your book thousands of hours probably, and yet somebody else looks at it. And that's what Margie Lawson has such a gift of, looking at things from this totally different perspective, and she shows you there is a layer there that you never saw before. You look her up. She has seminars you can take. She has those intensive where you go for like a week or weekend or something. She's amazing.
I've actually had her at my house. So,
oh, awesome.
And we're trying to do another one next year. The pandemic really broke our stride, because you've got to do something for yourself every year just to be sharp. No matter how many times you hear it, sometimes you just need that refresher, just looking from a different perspective or somebody else being able to point out. I'm a big fan of that.
Your novels tend to carry a very proper ladylike voice, whether you're saying something dastardly or not. You carry a very ladylike voice. Does this stay with you when you're writing? Are you hearing that voice?
It's
mama.
You can't get a kid through all this Shakespeare or Jane Austen and not be scathed. You know, there's something that's going to be stuck. Recently, I had to write, it's a dual timeline. And one of the timelines was 1990s. Dude, that was harder. I have an older voice and trying to make it sound current and fresh. And that was hard.
Well, 1990, I know that's historical, but it seems like it was yesterday.
But I didn't quite remember.
But you did it.
So it's funny, right? But that's trying that ladylike proper voice is not a 1990s voice. And you want it to feel like we're back in the 1990s. American, that was hard. So I props all you contemporaries.
Well, you may have just answered my next question. What has writing taught you about yourself?
Writing has taught me to actually trust my gut, especially in the beginning. You don't know you have a gut. You don't understand your voice and you're searching for this mystical voice thing. And then someday you realize you actually have a voice. That is the way your words are put together. That's the way you sound. That is the truth that you're trying to have these characters find. And it was really there all along. You just didn't recognize it because you so want to soak in. And there's nothing wrong. You want to soak in. You have to soak in. But that just will help you realize that you have your voice and it's special and it's unique. And you can trust it when telling a story. You get a point where you trust it so that you know what to fight for in a story that you're writing for. And you know when, you know what, that's absolutely right. I need to, that's not what I was looking for. That's not the story I'm trying to tell. I need to change it.
Well, thank you, Vanessa.
Thank you for having me.
Learn more at VanessaRiley.com.
If you're enjoying The Writing Table, please consider leaving us a review. There are so many podcasts out there. Reviews help other listeners find us. Thanks so much for your support.